The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the Yes And moment in your work and in your life. Yes And is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Jamie Cassop. Jamie is the Chief Education Evangelist at Google, where he evangelizes the power and potential of the web, technology, and Google tools as enabling and supporting capabilities in pursuit of fostering inquiry-driven, project-based learning models. Jamie collaborates with educational organizations and leaders around the world, building innovation and iteration into our educational practices. He has spoken at South by Southwest, EDU, TEDx, the Business Innovation Factory Summit, and was invited by the First Lady of the United States to speak at the Beat the Odds Summit at the White House. In addition to his role at Google, Jamie serves on the board of directors for the Arizona Science Foundation, New Global Citizens, and Inquire Schools. He is also an adjunct professor at Arizona State University, where he teaches classes and guest lectures. Jamie Cassop, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So this was interesting. I normally walk around Second City before I come in for one of these interviews, and everyone's like, who do you have on the podcast? And I'm like, well, I've got Jamie, who's the Chief Education Evangelist at Google. And half the people are like, oh my God, and like give me questions that they want me to ask you. And the others have no idea that Google is in the education space.
Right. Yeah, that happens sometimes. But I think most people recognize that, you know, we've been in the education space the day we launch, right? The first time you type something in a search bar, we're involved in education, whether we liked it or not.
Exactly. So for those who don't really know, can you give us a basic sense of the kind of stuff that Google does in the education space?
Yeah, like I said, we've been in education since the beginning, but in a more programmatic way, we are involved in a number of things, right? We have what we call G Suite, which we used to call Google Apps for Education, which is your Gmail and your calendar and your docs and your slides and all that as a package that schools use, both in higher education and in K-12, focused on communication and collaboration. So the same set of tools that you use if you have a Gmail account, we have a package that administrators can use with their domain name, so it's their school name at their school for students. And we have, I think the last public number was 70 million students and teachers around the world using that tool. So that's one example. Another one that's big in education is Chromebooks. We have Chromebooks in a whole bunch of schools, including in the Chicago area, that are in Chicago public schools that are using these tools to communicate, to collaborate, to research, do their work. So we have Chromebooks. And then we have a number of other packages that are interesting for schools, such as CS First, which is a elementary school program that teachers can introduce kids to computer science and coding in their schools, and they don't have to be computer scientists to do that. We have a package that's called Digital Leadership Skills that get kids to understand and how to use the Internet. So we have a bunch of stuff. You can visit our website at do a search for Google for Education and see all the programs that we have.
So I saw a study that you did at Google that found no correlation between test scores and performance. So if test scores aren't predictive of success, do you know what is?
Yeah, you know, it's the same stuff that we've been talking about for a really long time, right? Mm-hmm. We did a study with the Economist Group, and we asked employers all over the world, what are the most important skills you have you need your employees to have? And it is the same stuff that we've been looking at forever, right? Problem solving, critical thinking, creativity, communication, collaboration.
Yep.
We've been talking about this list for so long, we call them 21st century skills. Wow. Without ever stopping to think that we are 18 years into the 21st century. Yeah. Right? We have kids who are going to be starting in our schools that are going to be around in the 22nd century. So we've been talking about this list for so long.
Yeah.
But now it's time to actually go out and make these things real.
Yeah, you know, and when you and I were corresponding a little bit, I know you know a little bit about improvisation, and all those things that you just mentioned are the cornerstone of improvisation. So back in, you know, the mid-50s, or actually even earlier in the 20s and 30s, when they were developing all these improv games, these people are geniuses because they had a keen sense that human beings aren't oriented to collaborate well together or necessarily to instigate creativity. So you have all these exercises that require empathetic listening, that require you to problem solve in collaboration, to be creative in groups and with audiences, all the stuff that's sort of coming to life today. And then you add on the sort of digital layer, which is so important in terms of access, and we're going to get into all of that. And it's really amazing that we really are dealing with the same essential problem for the last 50, 60 years.
Yeah, but it's more so now than ever, and I think it's a mind shift, right? I think, you know, schools were set up for an individual sport.
Yeah.
And that was great. It served the economy great. I'm not one of those guys that stand up and say the education system is broken, because it worked for me. I'm a first generation American. I was raised on food stamps and welfare in New York City, and education is the reason I'm talking to you today. And I meet thousands of people that are like me that it's also worked for. So it's not necessarily that education broke. I think that's the wrong narrative. I think the narrative should be that we no longer live in a single-player sport world, that we now live in a team-based world, and what we need to do is some structural things into the education system to prepare our kids for a future that we're just starting to understand what it's going to look like.
I heard someone say, and I forget who said it, that when you think about what you just said, we're playing soccer and not basketball. You've got bigger teams, more global, all that. And when I was looking at your particular POV, which I really, really love, you said, quote, education is the great equalizer, and technology breaks down barriers between rich and poor students.
That's the purpose. I hope so.
Yeah. So talk to us about what are the sort of digital inequities that exist right now?
Well, part of it is just, you know, the way things were used to be before technology came up, right? So, for example, when I was a kid and I had to research something, if you asked me a question and I didn't know the answer to that question, I'd say, hang on, I will be back tomorrow, I'm going to go find out, right? And I would go home to get my encyclopedia, except I didn't have encyclopedias. I was too poor, right? I had the M, that's all I had. But I didn't have a whole bunch of encyclopedias, so I'd have to go to the library, and the library closed at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and it wasn't open on the weekends. Today, any kid can ask a question, and they have the access at their fingertips. You know, we have 100 million Columbus libraries at their fingertips. So how do we start taking advantage of that? And I think we're at the very beginning of trying to figure out how to take advantage of that.
And wireless is important, though, too, right? Because kids might have the Chromebook at school, but if they don't have Wi-Fi at home, they don't have all that access.
Yeah, no, and I think there's an access issue here that we have to deal with, right? This is common sense, but if you live in a rich family, there's like a 98% chance that you have internet access at home. If you live in a poor family, there's like a 30% chance. And even that internet access that you have, to your point, might be a parent with a phone that might not have that much data, for example, right? So there are definitely access issues that we need to deal with. We need to make sure that we have broadband across the board, that kids have access to technology, but we can also do some structural things. For example, homework, from my perspective, is an equity issue, right? Mm-hmm. My 16-year-old, who, when he does homework, he has access to every rocket scientist that works at Google. Mm-hmm. Not every 16-year-old kid has that access. So it's an equity issue across the board. So how do we make sure that we build instruction that can be taken care of during the school day so that kids can have their time in the afternoon and in the evening?
Yeah, I don't want to like drown in numbers, but I found this one amazing, that there's an 18-month academic gap between rich kids and poor kids by the time they get to kindergarten, which is an astronomical amount of time at that age.
Yeah, not only that, though. Here's the thing, when you dig deeper into those numbers, what you'll find is that 18-month gap stays the same throughout the years. So in other words, when a kid is in third grade, he'll be testing worse because he's poor than the rich kid, but doesn't mean school failed him. It means that they were already behind when they got there. So what we need to do is have a surge of services, especially in early education, so that kids have the catch-up right there. So during the early ages, 3, 4, 5, 6, they can actually catch up and surpass the 18-month gap.
So it's a couple things, right? So yes, there's the technology aspect and the access and the equity, but there's also the sort of the old models of behavior. And I really like how you frame this. You say, quote, the question used to be, what do you want to be when you grow up? Now it should be, what problem do you want to solve?
Right. Yeah, I talk to lots of students. I love talking to students. I teach. Actually, the other thing to my bio that I got to add is I also now teach 10th grade communication skills at the Phoenix Coding Academy here in Phoenix. And by the way, I tell them all to take drama if they want to be better speakers.
Yeah.
But my point there is that I ask students whenever I talk to a student, how many of you have been asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? And every single kid forever has raised their hand. We ask that question to fifth graders. The problem is we don't know what the world's going to look like in 20 years. We don't know. I'm working in a job and for a company that didn't exist when I graduated from graduate school. 60% of the jobs of the future don't exist. Jobs are constantly changing. Automation is impacting all jobs across the board. I was at NASA yesterday. Don't get me started on automation. The things that are coming gives us an opportunity to reframe that question. So not asking kids what they want to be when they grow up, but instead ask them what's the problem that they want to solve, because the more important question is the second question, which is, what do you need to know to solve that problem? What are the knowledge, skills, and abilities that you need to solve that problem? And then you can start kind of building your own curriculum, if you will, about everything that you need to get good at so that you can solve that problem.
So this is a universal theme among the people we talk about in education, the people we talk about in CEOs and human resource people, the thing we talk about with artists. And you talked earlier about the four C's, communication, collaboration, critical thinking, and creativity. You have actually another one that you throw in there, which I think is really important, especially in light of what's going on in the world today, and that's global competency.
Mm-hmm.
So
absolutely.
Yeah. Talk to us about that. What does that mean for you?
Yeah, what that means for me is, you know, look, at the end of the day, what are we doing with schools? What are we doing with kids? We're preparing kids for the future, and we have to understand what that future looks like. And the future is definitely global, right? I work for a global company. I think in my career, I think I've worked for one company that wasn't global. Everything else was global. So we're always working across the board. Because of access to technology, there's no one I can't work with. So why am I limiting myself through language or through region and only working with folks here where you can walk across the board? The other thing that we have to think about is I put up a picture of the original Google.com when Larry and Sergey put a bunch of machines together at Stanford. Mm-hmm. And I show that picture to audiences and I say to them, this is the original Google. This is it. This is where it started. This is a couple machines tied to a server. And today, two kids have 1,000 times the power that Larry and Sergey had when they put those machines up. And that's exciting, but it's also scary because that could happen not just in rural Illinois, it could also happen in India and in China. We don't know where the next big companies are going to come from, and if we don't have a global perspective, we're never going to catch up.
So I'm curious, living in America today, as you do, and at a point in our politics where there seems to be a whole bunch of people who want to do the opposite, who don't want to look globally, who for that is some dirty word or some,
right.
Like, do you feel this is a hiccup, a cultural hiccup in our time, or is this something that actually sort of scares you on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, it scares me because we're living through it, but also I think I don't want to call it a hiccup because it feels more like it's more than that, but I think it's a phase that we've gone through before. We go through these phases where like, oh, you know, the immigrants are bad, lock the doors, and then like, open the doors, let them in, oh, close the door. We go through these phases every couple of decades, and I think we're just in that phase now where the economy was really bad for a while, and we had somebody to blame, and now we're seeing that the economy's picking up and getting stronger, and so we're going to need more workers, right? Like, the first time somebody's going to go try to buy a head of lettuce for $12, they're going to say, bring them back, right? So one of those phases that we're going through. But the main point is that we think that we're the ones who are building the future, but when we start looking at numbers, you know, think about the number of students that are in China or the number of students that are in India. And if they have access, you know, one of the advantages we used to have was access to technology, access to information, access to knowledge. And if they have the same access, what does that mean for the future of the economy? Where is it going to grow from? And we're not that much in charge anymore.
Yeah, we talked to Raj Sisodia about this, who wrote the book on conscious capitalism. He says, you know, as scary as the world seems today, the access to information in places like India has never been greater,
right.
And that we're the most peaceful that the planet has been in a long while. So, you know, and that does speak to this idea of, like, just because things seem crazy in America, and they are, it doesn't mean that there isn't incredible work going on all over the world, and it's just not us anymore.
Right. And we have to learn how to cooperate. We have to learn how to collaborate. We have to learn how to work together. And you have to have some global competency to understand how the rest of the world works.
So you got hired by Google in 2006, right?
Right.
What was your first gig? Like, what'd you get hired for?
So I actually got hired to try to run the Google office that we had in Phoenix. And what happened was, I was actually looking for a project to work on because we were on the ASU campus, and the CIO said, ASU is going to come at you with 1,000 projects. Go find the good ones. And mm-hmm. I met with the CIO at ASU, and I asked him what his biggest problem was, and his biggest problem at the time was email. They were they had 70,000 students, and every single student had their own email account. They weren't using the ASU account. And I said, hey, we got this tool called Google for Your Domain. You should check it out. And Google Apps for Education was born out of ASU, and that's how I got into the education space. And I saw the excitement and the possibility of what we can do with technology and education, so I've been doing it for the last 12 years.
So Google's in the classroom, and that's totally cool, and it's great, but it does freak some people out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of curious, like, why are people threatened by Google from your POV?
Well, so I think it's important to understand that what we need to teach kids is how to be good digital citizens, but also be digital leaders. And what I mean by that is they need to know how to stay safe online, stay secure online, stay private online. They need to know how to vet information, look for information, understand the difference between real information and information that might not be so real, right? Stanford did a study recently. They looked at elementary school kids, and 80% of elementary school kids that they studied couldn't tell the difference between a sponsored website and a real news site.
Wow.
And so there are some issues there that we have to deal with. Now, so I get some of the paranoia, but we also, I hope we've done a good job. And if you go to our website, we have what we call a trust page. And very clearly laid out, we talk about what happens to the data, right? We don't mine the data. We don't go through the data. We don't serve ads to students. We are not collecting it, so that when they grow up, we can feed it back to them through advertising. We're not doing any of that, and some of those rumors are out there, so we lay out very clearly what the agreement is between a school and Google and a student and a parent and what parents can do. At the same time, I encourage parents to go visit that page, but I also encourage parents to think about how they can best prepare their kids, forget students, but just their kids, to live in this digital world, because information is coming at them at such a rate of speed, right? There's 400 hours of video that gets uploaded on YouTube every minute, right? There's 3.9 million Google searches every minute. That information is going to keep coming at them. We got to make sure that they're leaders when it comes to the use of digital tools.
I hadn't thought about it in this way. So, you know, part of what we teach in improvisation is we create safe spaces where people can fail. So we give them the opportunity to try stuff out, have it not work, and then, but no one has been killed, you know, and then we're able to pick ourselves up. So we develop this sort of resiliency muscle around creativity. But, you know, the kids are tied to their digital devices, and I don't know that they have many safe spaces to fail in that context, which would probably be a good thing at a young age before it could get serious and out of hand.
Yeah, no, they need to learn how to use these tools. Again, that stat that I gave you from Stanford is scary. I've been in a digital space for a very long time, and even I, with my kids, I have a 25-year-old and a 16-year-old, besides a 3-year-old, because I can only handle one child at a time, but that's another story.
Yeah.
And my 25-year-old and 16-year-old had very specific digital rules. And we, you know, I taught them how to be safe online, how to be secure online, how to be private online. I didn't even dream of teaching them how to tell the difference between a real news site and a fake news site, or a real news story and a fake news story. That just wasn't an idea 2 years ago, as far as I was concerned. And so I have to now go back and teach my 16-year-old how to know whether something's real or not. So we practice that all the time. So when my 16-year-old come in and say, you know, Barack Obama is actually from Mars. I'm like, okay, why don't we check that source and let's dive into this. We need to teach them that. And if we don't do that, then where are they going to learn how to do this if they don't learn how to do this in schools?
Yeah, our kids are roughly the same age, except I don't have the young one. I've got a 20-year-old and a 15-year-old. But they also went to a Waldorf school. So their entire grade school experience was no media. They had it home. But it was a very specific environment. But so I think for the older one, he was kind of learning when we were learning, as stuff was coming out. But our daughter, our 15-year-old, is so much more digitally savvy than we are, and the technology has changed, right? So Nick, our older one, was dealing with Facebook, and then putting his life out there for everyone to see. But Nora then had Snap or Secret, stuff that disappeared.
Right.
And that's where we started to have the conversation about, let's talk about the context of this, because, this is part of your life now. It just is. We can't run from it or hide from it. Again, speaking to the sort of global issues as well. How do we safely get our arms around it? So I imagine a place like Google, which is one of the biggest companies in the world, in very focused on making money, but also recognizes that that's nothing if they don't have purpose. What's the balance inside there? Are you one side of that coin where you're the purpose guy and they know to listen to you in terms of the need to pay attention to that stuff?
Yeah, I think we all do. I think, look, we when we hire folks at Google, we're trying to hire the smartest people, but we're also trying to hire leaders, and we're trying to hire people who want to get good work done in the right way. Got to remember the change in balance in life, right? If we think about this next generation, your 15-year-old, the Generation Z, right? Think about this generation, who they are. They are truly the first digital generation. They don't know that the world existed before Google. They don't know that the world existed before smartphones and tablets, or Wi-Fi for that matter. But they're also the first, they're also the Great Recession generation, right? Your 15-year-old doesn't know what good times in America used to look like, right? We've been talking about bad times for the last 15 years. Or I call them the 9/11 generation, right? They don't know what the world looked like before 9/11, right? When we were kids, I'm not saying you're old. When I was young, we would talk about, sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Yeah.
This generation, your 15-year-old, is like, the earth is dying, right? That's a completely different conversation. So they don't want to come work for you to make money. They want to change the world. They want to solve problems. They want to have an impact, right? They know, they recognize that 70% of Americans are disengaged with their work. They don't want that same experience. They want a different experience. So you, whether Google or other companies, need to set up this environment. You mentioned social venture, capital. These ideas that you can make money and do good at the same time, and I think that's where the future is headed. And I'm excited by that.
Yeah, me too. And I have this conversation with the owner at Second City, who's a baby boomer, and I'm Gen X, right on the bubble.
Yeah, so am I.
But part of, Andrew, our owner, comes from, the album The Who Sells Out, right? So he's always like, because we do a ton of corporate work at Second City. It's the biggest part of our, it's the biggest moneymaker as by divisions. And he's like, I don't know if we want to talk about it. And I'm like, Andrew, the new generation, the millennials, they admire the fact that you're able to do business as long as the work is authentic and smart and funny, and we're still producing people like Stephen Colbert and Jordan Peele or Tina Fey or whomever. But it's very hard for him to sort of wrap his head around there. And I know for myself, I try to keep tabs on my perceptions or presuppositions because the world has changed. We're often generationally just trying to keep up with the changes when they've already happened.
Right. And on top of that, they're happening at such a rate of speed that we're just never going to be able to catch up, right?
Yeah.
So this is a true story from Christmas. Last Christmas, my daughter, who now actually lives in Hell's Kitchen where I grew up, except now, she laughs at the fact that I talk about the old Hell's Kitchen stories because, she'll text me and say, I paid $21 for 3 tacos last night, right? So
right.
It's a completely different neighborhood.
Yes.
And she works at CNN doing exactly what she wants to do, film producer, exactly what she wants to do. And she wanted a Polaroid camera for Christmas last year, right? That's what she wanted. She remembered my old Polaroid camera, loved being able to take pictures with it. She used to play with it when she was a kid. My 16-year-old, right, is like, what's a Polaroid camera? Mm-hmm. He has no idea. He had never seen one before. And my three-year-old is like, what's a camera? Right? Like, she doesn't even know what a camera is, right? So that's how fast the technology is coming at us. And so we have to stay on top of it, but we also have to take advantage of that our kids aren't petrified of the technology. They're not scared of it. They're using it. And we just got to make sure that it's a partnership between adults and students and kids and parents, that everyone's on the same page to make sure that everyone's doing the best possible thing with these new tools, because they're not going anywhere.
I'm curious, too, for you. So I watched a lot of your interviews and read a lot of stuff, and you have a very positive outlook on this stuff, without denying the sort of terrible numbers that we're dealing with in terms of inequity and in this country. Where's that come from? Because it's not like you didn't have a charmed childhood.
Right.
So is that something that's just a muscle that you've already had, or something that you had to develop over time?
Yeah, so I think it comes from stubbornness. I don't like to be told. I don't like to be told that something is true, right? It's like you kids like you don't graduate from high school. Oh yeah, I'll show you. Kids like you don't go to college. Kids like you don't work at Google, right? Like, it's just been that. So when you say to me, you know, when someone will say, you know, Latinos aren't good at math, I'm like, okay, we'll see. All right, it comes from a stubbornness, but it also comes from, you know, I wish I came up with a term, but, you know, it's about Steve Jobs, and I'm not saying I'm Steve Jobs, but it's the reality distortion field, right? Like, right. I believe something. I believe that we can get to equity. I believe that we can educate kids. I believe that this next generation of kids are going to do some amazing things, and I don't care what you say. That's what I believe, and that's my reality.
Yeah, and I do think, I find this in our creative work, that the best stuff comes out when there's a tension. So if your tension is between stubbornness and empathy, that's a great place to be. Because you're going to have drive, but you're also going to be focused on the person across from you and what their needs actually are.
Yeah, I just think, look, at the end of the day, the work that I'm doing now is exactly what I want to be doing, right? When, you know, you talk about the work that you guys do, and I finally understand when a baseball player says, I can't believe they play me to play this game, right?
Right.
Every couple of weeks I go to the mailbox and I'm like, oh look, I get pay stubs. I forgot that Google pays me for this. It's the old adage about what would you do if you won $400 million in Powerball? And for me, I would just have my own plane. But besides that, I would still do exactly what I'm doing today.
Yep.
And that's what I see in this next generation, a generation of kids who don't care about status and don't care about how cool your car is, right? That they want experiences. I'm the only regret I have is that I'm not younger, that I don't get to hang out with 16-year-olds and take that on because of the tools that they have at their fingertips and what's possible with what they can do.
100%. Okay, we ask every guest who comes on the podcast for a yes and story. So the idea here in improvisation is if it's groups of people making something out of nothing, you accomplish nothing by saying no. You can't accomplish anything, and you can't say yes, but you have to say yes and. Do you have a yes and story for us?
That's funny, because I actually have one from yesterday. My 50th birthday is coming up in December, and I travel 200,000 miles a year. And so the birthday of my weekend, Star Wars comes out the next day, so that's what I'm doing all day. But besides that, we have the weekend, and my wife's like, why don't we go out of town for your birthday? And I'm like, usually I'm like, no, I want to stay home. I'm always on an airplane. I don't want to go anywhere. But I actually, you know, when she looked at me and said, let's just go, let's go to Cabo, let's go somewhere. And I said, and my yes and is yes, and let's do it up, right? Let's get let's get the big room, let's get the spa package, and let's do it up, right? Because that's, you know, it's for me, I don't like to necessarily travel when I don't have to travel, but my wife doesn't get out a lot to do these types of things, so I'm doing it for her. So I'm a big fan of the model, because I think it does work, and shutting things down doesn't work. We actually, my team took one of your classes when we were in Chicago a couple years ago, and it was great. It was everyone had a blast, and I think it opens up people's brains to do creative things.
Yeah, well, you know, our default setting is to do nothing. That's behavioral science has taught us that over and over again. So you're really fighting against these things that are already happening in your brain, where it's easier to shut it down. And then, because honestly, most of the times when you yes and something, you do find yourself going out and trying something you weren't going to do, and it feels good. And then you're like, we're fighting that always. So,
And that's part of the problem that we have to deal with education, is that we need to teach kids how to fail. We need to teach them how to keep trying and keep doing things in different perspectives, and not giving them endpoints, right? Like, what's the C in journalism? right, that you got 70% of the facts right, but you still passed, like, that doesn't make any sense. So we got to change some of the structural things so that we can create those environments where kids can always be doing the and yes kind of thing. Yes and thing.
Yep. Jamie Cassop, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. Well, I've been working in a coal mine going